Hello everybody, welcome to the lecture number two. Now you remember the last time I mentioned in the course I'm going to be giving a combination of anecdotes and also stories about Murray Rothbard and also a discussion of his views and arguments, and I try to do a blend of both. Now, last lecture, I spent most of the time giving the history of Rothbard, what he did, how he synthesized the 19th century libertarian individualist anarchist tradition of Benjamin Tucker, Lysander Spooner with Austrian economics. But this time, although I'll put in a few anecdotes, I'm going to concentrate mainly on particular views and arguments that Rothbard had. So this will be perhaps a bit more difficult than the earlier lecture. I hope it doesn't discourage anybody, but I'm very hopeful. I think this is a particularly important lecture because I'm going to be spending a lot of time, what I consider is a crucial issue in ethics. We're going to discuss Rothbard's view of ethics and political philosophy, which he thought was part of ethics, kind of the reverse of Aristotle thought ethics was part of politics, and Rothbard had taken the other view. He said, no, ethics is the bigger subject, and political philosophy is a branch of that, and we'll see exactly later in the lecture what the distinguishing characteristic of political philosophy is. But as I say, what I want to cover today, and this will be very good if I can get this across, if you get through this lecture, you'll understand, if you didn't already, a really fundamental issue in ethics and how various people divide on this issue, how people see this particular issue in different ways, and so we'll be able to grasp this. And what I want to be specific, what I want to concentrate on is a difference in ethics between Murray Rothbard and Ludwig von Mises. Remember, Mises was very important to Rothbard. He started attending Mises' seminar at NYU in 1949. He was extremely impressed by Human Action, which came out in that year. His Manichaean State is based on Mises. Mises also thought very highly of Rothbard. Rothbard was perhaps the greatest person who attended his seminar, so they both thought very highly of each other. And they have very similar views about policy, especially economic policy. Both of them, as you know, supported the free market. They would always oppose government intervention in the economy, not, of course, socialism. They would be against. Mises argued that socialism was really impossible. It couldn't calculate, and government intervention in the economy doesn't work. And of course, Rothbard agreed with that completely and extended Mises' views on that, showing in more detail how various types of intervention would fail. So what's the big difference? Well, the difference, and this is this key issue that I want to try to convey to you, if I can, concerns the foundation of ethics. Now we have to understand, before we can understand Rothbard, we have to understand Mises, because Rothbard's views in Ethics of Liberty developed in reaction to the position of Mises. So usually Rothbard is saying Mises is really great, we have to follow what Mises says. Mises was the greatest economist 20th century, so we have to do what he said was almost always right. But in ethics, he had very different views. And I should say when he first started criticizing Mises, he was very reluctant to do so. He was kind of skittish about coming out and differing with Mises. There was a conference held in the late 1950s by the Volcker Fund that Mises attended, and Murray Rothbard was there kind of reporting on the conference for the Volcker Fund. And at the conference, Mises gave a paper on his views on ethics. And one of the other people in the conference was Leo Strauss, who was a very well-known political philosopher who taught at the University of Chicago. And Strauss criticized what Mises said. He thought that Mises' position wasn't right. And Rothbard inclined to agree with Leo Strauss on this particular point. Generally, he didn't agree with Strauss on contemporary politics, but he thought Mises was wrong, so he was very reluctant to come out with that, but he eventually did. And you can read, if you're interested in the Mises paper and Strauss's paper, you can read it's in a book called Relativism and Values, edited by Helmut Scheck, S-C-H-O-E-C-K, and James Wiggins, that published by Van Nostrand Company. Mises and Leo Strauss, the two people who differed, they're both exiles from Germany, in the case of Strauss, and Austria, in the case of Mises. They both come over to America. Mises really didn't like Leo Strauss. It wasn't just that Strauss differed with him. He really didn't like him much. He commented to Rothbard, "Oh, he's just a high school teacher. You don't have to take him seriously." So, imagine, given that Mises said that, Rothbard wasn't too anxious to let Mises know that he agreed with Strauss, but he did. Now, the key point that we have to understand, to understand what Mises is saying, what Rothbard is reacting to, is this. When we're reasoning, we're reasoning about science or history, we're talking about theoretical reason. Say if I'm studying physics or biology, I'm reasoning in a certain way, so I'm developing certain theories. But there's also an issue we could call practical reason. Let's say, suppose I have to do something, like I'm faced with some choice, like what am I going to do? Should I steal money from somebody if I think I can get away with it? So there's an issue there of what is the thing to do in practice? How should I do things? We're concerned with action. And the key issue that comes up is, what is the scope of reason when we're dealing with questions of action? And the answer differs with different people. So the question is, for theoretical reason, there's more agreement. We know how we use reason in achieving, trying to come up with different kinds of theories. But people differ on what is the scope of practical reason. And according to Mises, the only role for reason when we're dealing with questions of action is how we can use means to achieve ends. I give an example here. Suppose I want to learn Austrian economics. So I say, well, I should study human action. So here, what is this? Let's look at the sense of, I want to learn Austrian economics, I should study human action. So here what we're doing is, I have a certain goal, I want to learn Austrian economics, and then I'm saying that studying human action is a means to achieve that goal. So according to Mises, that's something we can look at and ask, is this correct or not? Is that in fact a way to learn Austrian economics? to study human action. Is this a suitable means to achieve the end that I have? So here there's scope for reason, because I can say, given that I have a certain end, it can be any end you want, I could then say, what is the best means to attain that end? How can I get that end? And that isn't a question that the question of how do I achieve the end, how do I get to the end, isn't something that is arbitrary or just up to me. That's a question that's objectively true. Is this the means to achieve an end? So that's something that's capable of being settled by reason. Now, suppose though we have an end, we say I have a certain goal. Now I could have that goal, let's say I want to learn Austrian economics because, let's say, I think I want to get a job at the Mises Institute, and I think I need to know Austrian economics in order to do so. So there, this end here, I want to learn what's an end in this sense, would be a means to some further end, namely, I want to get a job at the Mises Institute. So we could then say, well, is learning Austrian economics a suitable means to get a job at the Mises Institute? Will this help you get a job at the Mises Institute? So again, we would have what was the end in this sense become the means for this other goal. But suppose you had an end that wasn't a means to any further end. Say, suppose you say, well, I just want to be happy. So suppose you say, well, why do you want to be happy? And you just say, well, I just do. That's my goal. I want to be happy. It isn't that I want to be happy in order to get something else. I just want to be happy. So suppose you have an end that isn't a means to further end, then, and this we have to understand if we're going to get what Mises, understand what Mises is saying, and this is what Rothbard is going to be reacting again. Mises says that an end that isn't a means to some further end is neither rational nor irrational. It's just there. So you just got it, that's it. So you can't say, as you could when you're dealing with evaluating how a means will achieve an end, you can say, well, this is either right or wrong. This is either a suitable means to learn Austrian economics or not. Suppose I said, if I want to learn Austrian economics, I should read Mein Kampf. Well, that wouldn't be a very suitable way to learn Austrian economics. If you read Mein Kampf, you'd find out quite a bit about Hitler, but you wouldn't learn Austrian economics. So that wouldn't be a good means. And that isn't a question of just depending on people's preferences. That's an objectively true statement, that this is a good means to achieve an end or it isn't. So there, the means to achieve an end, to get an end, is subject to rational judgment. But according to Mises, if you've got an end that is not a means to some other end, then you can't go any further with reason. It's just got particular people's preferences. Now, Mises, so then you see, if you might think, well, Mises had that view, then wouldn't we be in trouble, because then you just have people would have all these different ends that weren't means to further ends, and then there's nothing more you could say about them. You just have people differing on different goals that they had. But Mises said, in fact, almost everybody wants prosperity and peace. So even though in his view, if you want prosperity and peace, not as a goal to something else, but that's just your end, you don't have that as a means to a further end, you just want that, then that isn't either rational or irrational. Because remember, only means can be evaluated as rational or irrational, not ends. But in fact, nearly everybody wants prosperity and peace. Now, Mises, Rothbard didn't agree with Mises on this point. This is the issue, and remember I said at the beginning of the lecture that this particular issue is one of the key issues in ethics, and if you can understand this, we'll have a good grasp of a basic issue in ethics. I guess, let me just give you a couple questions that Malcolm had. One was, did Rothbard and Strauss disagree on what was wrong with Mises' argument and agree on the solution? Well, Strauss didn't develop his views on ethics in the same way that Rothbard did, but Mises more agreed with some of Strauss's particular arguments on the nature of values. But I won't be going into particular Straussian arguments in this lecture. And another question Malcolm has, is this related rational or irrational disagreement connected to Rothbard's view that cultural conservatism was a presupposition for libertarianism? No, that's a different issue. That really is, this issue, that would be something else. This is just, the question is, if you have an end that isn't a means to a further end, do you have to just say, well, that's the person's preference, or can you say, well, maybe he shouldn't have that end, or he should have that end? So Rothbard thought that ethics is objective, and what do we mean by this? That, well, suppose we say, for example, that we ought to promote the free market. According to Rothbard, this tells us what we ought morally to do. It's sort of a claim that's true. It isn't just a claim of how we can realize the preference for peace and prosperity that we in fact have. It's saying, well, we should have this, we should want the free market regardless of whether we feel like it or not. This is just the right thing to want. So you see the difference here. Mises said, well, ultimate ends are really arbitrary. People just have them. We can't say they're rational or irrational, right or wrong. It's just people have these ends. But given that nearly everybody wants peace and prosperity, we can ask, how do we achieve that? He says the way we achieve that is through social cooperation, through the free market. Rothbard says, it isn't just that people have these preferences. They ought to want these. You can have judgments of what's rational or irrational, not just about means, but about ends that aren't means to further ends, or what means is called ultimate ends. So Rothbard would say, just as, say, when we're investigating principles of mathematics, we're finding out what's going on, what the truth is. Say, when mathematicians come up with their theorems, they're not just inventing theorems according to their personal preferences, or they're not just coming up with some social institution in which they prove things. They're finding out what really is true in the world. So Rothbard thinks that's the case with morality, that some people, that there are truths about morality. It's not just a matter of how we realize preferences that we in fact have. We're dealing with matters of objective truth. I've been repeating this a number of times because it's a really important issue that we need to understand, not only to get through this course about Rothbard, if you're interested in ethics and political philosophy, this is a really big issue that you need to think about and come up with it, see how you, what, where you stand on it. As I say, this is one of the most important controversies in ethics, is morality or ethics objective. So, now, as most philosophers would understand this question, whether morality is objective, this question means, can moral judgments be true or false? So, according to Mises, suppose you say, peace and prosperity are good. That wouldn't be either true or false, according to Mises. It would just be the case that, in fact, most people take those to be desirable. But you wouldn't be able to say it's true that peace is good in the same way you could say it's true that 2 + 2 = 4. It isn't just a matter that people prefer that 2 + 2 = 4. It really is the case that 2 + 2 = 4. Mises would say that's not the case with, say, the judgment that peace is good. It just, it happens to be that most people want this. But if we're dealing with ends or goals that aren't means to further goals, then we can't really say what's right or wrong objectively. So if you say, can, if you say moral judgments can't be true or false, that's to accept a subjectivist position. For example, suppose I like vanilla ice cream, but you don't. So we wouldn't say that I'm right and you're wrong, or you're right and I'm wrong. It's just each of us has a different preference. That's all there is to it. So subjectivists think that moral judgments are like this. If, say, somebody said, well, I don't see anything wrong with being cruel to animals. You think this is very bad, but I don't. So according to subjectivists, they would say that's just a matter of preference, unless you're talking about some, say, if cruelty to animals was a means to some end, you could ask, is that a suitable means to achieve the end? But if it's just taken just as a preference, you couldn't say it's either right or wrong to have such a preference. Now, Kevin says, how can the idea of all values subjective be reconciled with the idea that ethics are objective? Well, of course, it couldn't be. That's the whole point. I mean, there's someone who holds that values are subjective can say, what's objective is the question of how do we achieve various goals. That isn't a subjective matter. What is it means to achieve an end? But if you think that all values are subjective, then ethics wouldn't be objective. Now, the other part of Kevin's question, is there really a problem holding both these two ideas to be true as it does at first seem? Well, I think you wouldn't be able to hold both are true. Now, you may be thinking something like this. In Austrian economics, it's held that values are subjective, but that isn't, there you're not dealing with ethics. There you're just saying, well, you're talking about how do you explain particular people's actions. Well, of course, what the values they themselves hold, not what values they ought to hold, if in fact there are any values they ought to hold. What you're dealing with is just what the preferences people, in fact, have. So that's perfectly consistent with the view that ethics is objective, because you could say, well, people have certain values, but they should have others. That's not a statement in economics, but if you hold an objective view of ethics, that's a coherent thing to say. I know I'm putting a lot of emphasis on this point, but I really think it's an important issue. So I want you to be able to see exactly what the issue is between Mises and Rothbard about objectivity. Now, Mises certainly thinks that there are many judgments that have something to do with ethics that are true or false. For example, the free market enables people to attain their preferences for peace and prosperity is true. Now, from what I've said before, can anyone tell me if Mises thought that the ultimate ends or ends that aren't means of further ends are neither rational nor irrational, how could he say that there are many judgments in ethics that are true? If he said, well, ultimate ends aren't either rational or irrational, how could he at the same time say that there are true statements you can make in ethics, such as this one? And Mount Hood, because those are a subset. And how would you characterize that subset? Well, you see, it's just their means to attain particular ends. So those are the true, according to Mises, those are the ones that can be true or false. You can say, is this means to attain a particular end? That's not a matter of preference. That's objectively true or false. But if it's just an end that isn't a means to achieve some other end, then according to Mises, it's neither true nor false and not subject to rational evaluation or judgment. So, as I say, I guessed somehow what was on this next slide. I don't know how I did that. So, according to Mises, ultimate value judgments are neither true nor false. For example, suppose someone doesn't want to be in pain. Now, obviously, you people aren't in that group since you're here listening to my lecture, and you're going to be in pain if you're listening to my lecture. So you can't be people who don't want to be in pain. But supposing somebody doesn't want to be in pain, and it isn't that he doesn't want to be in pain because of he has some further goal, like you could imagine, say, somebody says, I'll give you $1,000 if you can get through the next hour without suffering any pain as registered on this pain machine. So he wouldn't want to be in pain as a means of attaining this further goal. He wants the money. So it's not like that. The person just doesn't want to be in pain. So Mises would say it doesn't make sense to claim that this preference, namely not to be in pain, is either correct or incorrect. It's just that's just an ultimate preference that the person has. So Rothbard wouldn't agree with that. That Rothbard thinks that value judgments are objective in the regular straightforward sense of which judgment about facts are true or false. So suppose you say, well, it's a factual judgment. Say this person is in pain. You see the person's doubled over. He's in agony. So it's not a subjective preference that the person is in pain. He really is in pain. So Rothbard would say, not only is that true or false, but whether pain is good or not is something that is true or false. It's not just a matter of preference. Suppose there was some person who said, well, I really like being in pain. According to Rothbard, that wouldn't just be a different preference. You could say there would be, there's the person is wrong to have a preference of that kind. Now, how does Rothbard show that ethics is objective? It's easy. If you take Mises' position, you can really understand it very simply because you just say, well, what's rational is, will a means help you get a certain end? It doesn't seem to be any problem seeing how statements of that kind can be true or false. But how can you have judgments about ultimate ends that are true or false? So that seems like a much more difficult question. Suppose we say, well, suppose the mind just doesn't mind being in pain very much. In what sense could you say that person is wrong? Wouldn't we have to say maybe has some very unusual preference, but that's just the way things are? Why isn't this just like a case? Supposing, say, most people don't like, say, wouldn't like pouring tomato juice on ice cream. But suppose somebody does, why wouldn't you just say, well, that's just, he just has different tastes from other people. So why wouldn't we say this in questions of ethics? Why wouldn't we say, as Mises suggests, if somebody has a different ultimate end from most people, there's no more to be said about it. So Rothbard answered this question by appealing to natural law, especially as developed by St. Thomas Aquinas, the great 13th century philosopher, probably the greatest medieval philosopher, and also, I should mention, the fattest of all the great philosophers. St. Thomas was so fat that when he knelt down to celebrate Mass, they had to have a special altar cut out for him so he would be able to kneel down and get up again. David Hume was also very heavy, but not a, he wasn't in the Aquinas class. So, but that's just an aside. Now, how does natural law show that ethical judgments are objective? Rothbard answers the question by appealing to essences. So what do we mean by an essence? Say we're considering anything we want, like we can divide the properties of whatever we're dealing with, say a human being or a certain metal like gold or any substance, anything we want, we can divide the properties of the thing, namely what its qualities are. I don't mean the properties, what land it owns, but I mean the qualities it has, into two classes. One class is the essential characteristics. By essential mean, what are the characteristics or properties a thing has to have in order to be that object or that substance. For example, it's water's essence to be composed of hydrogen and oxygen. So suppose somebody said, well, I've got this thing here, it's kind of a liquid. If you tasted it, it tastes like ordinary water, but it's not composed of hydrogen and oxygen. If you did a chemical analysis, you'd come up with something else. So that couldn't be water because water has to be composed of hydrogen and oxygen. If it isn't, it isn't water. So being composed of hydrogen and oxygen is an essential property, essential characteristic of water. So that's what we mean by an essence. It's something that, what are the characteristics of an object such that it wouldn't be that particular object if it didn't have those characteristics. Now, what about other properties of the object, other qualities of the object, other than these essential characteristics? Those would be non-essential. For example, I could say, suppose I have here, I have a glass of water here. I'm just going to take it's a property of water that it's capable of being contained in this particular cup. There's at least some water that's in this cup, so water in general has a property, at least some of it is capable of being contained in this cup. But that isn't an essential characteristic of water. Suppose there was something about this cup that just prevented water from coming into it. That wouldn't affect the essence of water. That would just, it just happens to be the case that water is capable of going into this cup. So that would be a non-essential property of water. So what Rothbard, following Aquinas, suggests is we can determine the essence of human beings just as we can for other things, just as we can ask, what is the essence of water, or what is the essence or nature of gold? Essence and nature really mean the same thing. So you say, what is the nature of human being? Just as we can for other things. But you might, now I see another question from Malcolm here. Is this related to using systematic axiomatic deductive reasoning to get to a set ethics? Well, it can be, I mean, but you can, there are deductive elements in natural law, but what we're really trying to do here is just figure out what, if anything, gives them these, what are these central properties of human beings. So we wouldn't be deducing that from axioms, we'd just be looking at the notion of human beings and trying to figure out what the essence is. So the objection that might occur to people is, suppose you want to try to find out what the human essence is, wouldn't this be just part of anthropology's study of mankind rather than ethics? How could an account of a human essence tell us what we should do? For example, suppose you said the essence of human beings are rational animals. Well, that might be true, but how would that tell you what you should do? So how, even if you knew the human essence or human nature, would you be able to answer me would say ultimate ends are neither rational nor irrational, they're just there, people have them. So how would it, answer me is just to point out that human beings have a certain nature or essence. So that's an objection that might occur to people. And the way Rothbard answered this question, he appealed to the concept of flourishing or happiness. Say we say somebody's leading a happy life or a flourishing life. So we could ask, well, if you want to lead a happier, flourishing life, you need certain things, and those things would be dependent on human nature. Suppose you say, well, to lead a flourishing life, you need to have some sort of activity that will get you engage your intellect. You have to find some kind of productive work that will enable you to exercise your intelligence. So that would just be something that would be true because of the way human beings are. Human beings have a nature that makes it the case that they need productive work in order to flourish. So far, though, we haven't really come up with an objection to Mises. In fact, you could say we're illustrating what Mises would say, because this just says, if you want to flourish, you should do such and such. If you want to flourish, you should engage in productive work. So this is like Mises' claim, if you want peace and prosperity, you should favor the free market. So we don't seem to have any difference here so far from Mises. Just by appealing to the concept of flourishing in human nature so far, we haven't gone beyond what Mises is saying. Because Mises could say, all right, I can accept what you say. If you want to flourish, you should do such and such. But whether you want to flourish in the way you distinguish is just something that is just a preference. That can't be said to be right or wrong. So far, then we haven't got a basic difference between Mises and Rothbard. But here now, after this long preliminary, we can get to where the real point of difference is between Mises and Rothbard. Rothbard does not take human flourishing as a mere hypothetical. So according to Roth, in the natural law view that Rothbard is following, it's objectively true that this is a good. You should want to flourish even if you don't. So in saying this, Rothbard has rejected what's sometimes called Hume's law after this great 18th century Scottish philosopher David Hume. Remember, the other great philosopher besides Aquinas, not nearly as fat as Aquinas. So what Hume said, at least as he's usually interpreted, there are people who don't take him this way, Hume said, you can't derive an ought, a judgment about what we should do, from an is, just as judgments are statements about what is the case, what are certain facts about the world from a description of the world. So according to Hume, from the fact that certain things are needed for human flourishing, you can't say that we ought to try to get those things because we need them for flourishing. And Rothbard wouldn't agree with that. He thinks that if certain things are needed for human beings to flourish or to be happy, he thinks it follows that we ought to want these things. So Rothbard is saying, no, this ought judgment, we ought to do such and such, follows from the factual judgment certain things are needed for human flourishing. So Rothbard is rejecting this claim, sometimes called Hume's law, you can't derive an ought from an is. Now, we might wonder, is it right, how can Rothbard reject Hume's law? How is it supposed to follow from the fact that we need to do certain things to flourish, that we unconditionally ought to do those things? Say most people certainly want to flourish, but what if somebody didn't? What if somebody said, well, I just prefer just lying around all day and not doing anything. It's like this story, there were some people in an army barracks and the sergeant said, I'll give $20 to the laziest soldier in the barracks. And so various the soldiers were jumping and saying, I'm the laziest. And then one person in one of the bunks said, just roll me over and put the money in my back pocket. So here we would have a similar question. Well, what if somebody just said, I don't want to flourish? One response would be just to go back to the hypothetical and say, well, okay, you don't, but most people do. So if you want to flourish, you should do what you need to flourish. Now, this is Mises' position. Remember, we've gone over this. Mises said, you can ask, you can make rational judgments about how do you achieve a certain goal, but not about the goal itself, if that goal is ultimate, if it isn't a means to further goal. And also, Ayn Rand held this view, at least according to most, some interpretations of her thought. But it isn't standard natural law theory. Standard natural law theory tries to go beyond this hypothetical judgment. So in standard natural law theory, what you ought to do is not, repeat, is not dependent on your choosing something. You simply ought to do it. So if you have a choice, then morality would consist of hypothetical imperatives. If you choose to live, for example, you should do such and such. But standard natural law theory, and by standard natural law theory, I mean the theory developed by Aquinas, at least as most people interpret it, it isn't satisfied with this. It isn't satisfied with just this hypothetical saying, if you want this, you should do that. How, this of course raises the question, well, how do we get these non-hypothetical oughts? Rothbard answers by pointing out that living things have certain tendencies. For example, a normal colt will develop into a horse. That a pattern or standard pattern for horses that they develop in a certain way, so that, say, it starts off as a colt and then it'll grow into a horse. So a colt that failed to do that, that didn't develop into a horse, would be defective. And a good horse is one that develops normally. In this view, an animal should develop according to its tendencies. There's a plan for each animal studying that gives how that animal normally develops, and this is just what should means. That should means developing in accord with the tendencies of the particular animal. So we should want to flourish because this is part of this is part of our human nature. And a person who didn't want this would be abnormal. He would be acting against his nature. And in the natural law view, when you say you should act in accord with your nature, that's a statement that's true because just what should mean in this view is acting in accord with your nature. You see, so it's definitional, or it's conceptually true that you should act in accord with your nature. Now, there's a famous objection to arguments of this sort. I see a question here. Do essences relate to Plato's ideal type? Yes, there is a relation there in that Plato's ideal types would be examples, one theory about what essences are, but if you believe in essences, you wouldn't have to accept Platonic ideal types. That would just be a theory about the nature of essences, and Rothbard, following Aquinas and Aristotle, didn't hold that, but that would be one way of looking at essences. So what is this famous objection to arguments that I've just given, that namely say, you should act in accord with your nature. Well, suppose we ask, ought we to do or should we do what we need to flourish? So if ought or should means what we need to do to flourish, the question would make no sense. It would be like asking, ought we to do what we ought to do? You see the objection here, it's a little tricky, so let's make sure we understand this. So we're asking, ought we to do what we need to flourish? The person, the natural law advocate said, we ought to do what we need to flourish. And he claims this is really what ought means. Ought means doing what you need to flourish. So, of course, the statement is true. But the objection is, well, if what the natural law advocate is saying is right, this question doesn't make sense. It would be like asking, ought we to do what we ought to do? There'd be no point in asking. But the question does make sense, or at least seems to. Suppose we're looking at this question again, ought we to do what we need to flourish? Well, somebody could say, well, should we or shouldn't we? What if somebody doesn't want to flourish? It seems to make sense to ask, should somebody want to flourish even if he doesn't want to? It seems to make sense to ask that, but the objection is, it shouldn't make sense if the view is true. This is a variation of a famous argument by G. Moore called the open question argument. If you can ask a question, Moore did this about good. He said good was indefinable because suppose you said something like, suppose you say good is pleasure. You could ask the question, is pleasure good? Moore said, well, if pleasure is defined as good, you couldn't ask that question. It would be like asking, is pleasure pleasure? It wouldn't make any sense to ask it. But it does make sense to ask it. So therefore, good can't be defined. So this argument is similar to that. It's saying, if ought means acting according with your nature, we shouldn't be able to ask, ought we to do what we need to flourish? But we can ask that. Now, I know it's a bit difficult, but I think if you don't understand it right away, just go over the slide, and I think you'll get it. So Rothbard could reply to that, and I think he would. Well, if you think the question makes sense, you're just wrong about it. You're making a mistake. Maybe you think that because you're not really familiar with the correct natural law theory, but in fact, it is definitionally true that we ought to do what we need to flourish, in his opinion. So now, I've devoted, as I told you, most of the time to this issue. I hope I haven't beaten it to death, but I do think this is an extremely important topic to grasp. But I want to say a little bit more about what Rothbard did in political philosophy. We tried to show he thinks that there's objective true judgment about ethics. Now, he thinks that you can get some of these objectively true judgments in political philosophy, that political philosophy, in his view, is just part of ethics, and it's confined to setting forward or delimiting what is the permissible use of force. When can I use force or threaten force in order to get you to do something? So ethical issues that don't involve force aren't covered in political philosophy. And political philosophy establishes people's rights, which are claims that people can use force to secure. So if I have a right that, say, people not steal my belongings, I can use force against them if they do that. But supposing, say, maybe it would be wrong for people to insult me gratuitously. Suppose somebody said, well, this guy has a horrible voice. I don't like listening to him. Somebody said that about me recently on YouTube. I didn't like it much, but I couldn't, if I could find out who that person was, I couldn't use force against him because he hasn't violated any of my rights. So even if he's done something, maybe he shouldn't have said that, I can't use force about him. So that wouldn't be part of political philosophy. And this separation between political philosophy and other parts of ethics really comes from John Locke, the great English 17th century English philosopher. And there was a 19th century German philosopher, Fichte, who also stressed this, at least in his early works on ethics and political philosophy. So kind of, he was generally somewhat of an authoritarian, but he went through a somewhat anarchist or libertarian, I should say anarchist, but near libertarian phase of his career. And he stressed very much that ethics, that political philosophy is just one part of ethics. I should say also, according, I should have put this, said this a little earlier, but I'll put it in now. According to Rothbard, as I said, we use reason to determine what we need to flourish. So this would apply not just to political philosophy, but to all of ethics. And in contrast to Friedrich Hayek and Henry Hazlitt, Rothbard is suspicious of the role of custom and common law. So according to Rothbard, well, you always have to test results of common law by reason, so they don't have a presumption of truth. And if you studied Friedrich Hayek and Henry Hazlitt, they take a different view of that matter. But that's really somewhat of a digression, but I see I put that as a slide. I must have had some reason for it, but I can't quite figure out what it was, but there it is. So, as I say, Rothbard then thinks it's objectively true that we should do what we need to flourish, and to find out what we need to flourish, we need to use reason and not custom. Ah, now it's making sense to me why I put that slide in about custom, because if you want to know how to flourish, you want to know how do you find this out. So according to Rothbard, you don't do it by going to custom or appeal to legal traditions. You try to figure out by reason what you need to flourish. So he thinks that each person, in order to flourish, needs to be a self-owner. If I want to lead a happy life, then it has to be the case. I need to be able to prevent other people from interfering with my body. Each person has the right to decide what to do with his or her own body. For example, supposing someone needs one of your kidneys, say he's on dialysis, he's going to die unless he can get a kidney transplant, and you're a suitable donor. So you have two healthy kidneys, and you could get along with just one kidney. It would be somewhat painful to have the operation, maybe, but you could get along. So the person who needs this transplant needs the kidney much more than you do, but you're not required to give it to him just because he needs it more than you do. It's your body, so you have the right to determine what to do with it. It's your body, and that's what is meant by self-ownership. And Rothbard thinks this, you need to be a self-owner in order to flourish. Now, contrary to what some people think, self-ownership isn't a philosophically problematic concept. All it means is that each person should be in control about decisions about his or her own body, such as the kidney and blood donation examples I just mentioned. Now, some people get confused about this because they think, well, if you're talking about self-ownership, then you're suggesting that really the person's mind is separate from the body and the mind owns the body. Maybe you say, well, that's maybe Descartes thought that, but what if you don't hold that view of the way mind and body are related? Maybe you think that the mind is the brain, or is the mind can't be separated from the body. So how can you talk about self-ownership? Doesn't this imply some kind of controversial view that the mind is distinct from the body? But it doesn't. Self-ownership, as we're talking about here, doesn't involve any assumptions about the mind-body relation. When we talk about self-ownership, really the self is a reflexive pronoun. What do I mean by that? Well, suppose we say that somebody lacks self-esteem. We don't mean that the person's self lacks esteem for something else, for example, the person's body. We just mean the person doesn't regard himself very highly. So if you talk about someone with self-esteem, you're not suggesting any separation between the self and the esteem. So in a like way, a self-owner controls certain aspects of himself. It isn't that the owner is controlling, is a part of the person that's the owner that's controlling other parts of the person. It's just the person, just talking about the person as a whole, owns himself or controls certain aspects of himself. It's a reflexive pronoun. It's that I myself am doing this. That's reflexive. Myself is reflexive. So self-ownership is reflexive in this way. It's just saying it's not the case. Other people have a right to control your body. You do, and you're not making any controversial assumptions about relations of the mind and body. Now, there's some people who don't object to what I just say, but I say this isn't real ownership. In ownership, you have to have a separation between owner and what's owned. So if it's the case with self-ownership, there isn't such a separation. That really isn't ownership. I must say I find this an odd objection because, after all, ownership, the concept of ownership, isn't a thing in the world. Say we could say, "What? Here's some gold," or "Here's some water." We could say, "What is the nature of that thing?" That isn't up to people to decide. We just have to investigate, find out what the nature is of gold or water. But ownership isn't a thing in the world. It's a term that's invented for convenience. It doesn't have an essence. We can define it any way we want, as we please. Now, if you don't like the term self-ownership, you should feel free to use some other term. Nothing really turns on what word we use, but as I tried to show, there isn't anything wrong with talking about self-ownership, as many people think there is, unfortunately. Now, Rothbard said we need to be self-owners in order to flourish. Now, how does he make a case for that? Why should we accept that people are self-owners? Rothbard argues by contrasting self-ownership with alternative principles, including slavery, which would be a system where some people own others, and a system where, say, each person owns parts of everyone. So instead of being I own myself, you own yourself, I would own a certain part of you, you would own a certain part of me, we would all have fractional shares in everybody else. So Rothbard said, well, if we're considering slavery, isn't it obvious slavery is wrong. So at least at some point, Rothbard is what we could call a moral intuitionist. That's, say, someone who thinks we can grasp the truth of at least some moral claims. For example, suppose I say, it's wrong to kill babies for fun. But we just grasp, if we understand, if we just grasp that it's true, if somebody asked why it was true, you would really, really missing the point. We would, because we just, so when we understand it, we can just get that it's true. It's not dependent. Its truth isn't dependent on some particular theory. In some way, we say, well, what's wrong with slavery? We can get it kind of intuitively. We see, well, this is just not a right system to have. People shouldn't be able to subject others to their will as they do in slave system. Now, after he's established self-ownership, Rothbard goes on to develop an account of how people acquire property. And here he said, land and other natural resources start out unowned. Nobody has a claim to them at first. They're just out there. But people, since they're self-owners, own their own labor. And when they mix their labor, I mean, they do something with unowned land in an appropriate way, that then they acquire the land. So Rothbard starts out with people being self-owners. Here's all the natural resources that are unowned, and then people acquire these resources by doing something to that. And if that's how property rights are acquired, there's no room for a legitimate state, because the state would be, say, support itself by taxes, but it would be claiming the right to take people's property, and it would be also interfering with their freedom to make arrangements for protection as they see fit. It would be saying, you know, you can't choose to protect yourself by hiring such and such people to protect you. You have to rely on us. You're in our territory, but in Rothbard's view of how property is acquired, all the property is acquired by individuals, so there'd be no state that would be, or of course we have groups acquiring property, but there'd be no body of people who just say, well, we can determine how you should use your property, because the individuals are self-owners and then they acquire property in this way that Rothbard sets forward. So I'm just giving you a small bit on Rothbard's political philosophy, but I wanted to devote the principal attention to this key topic in ethics, that I thought is a very big topic. It's also one that I think students sometimes have difficulty with, and I'm hoping that after this lecture, you'll all be able to get this, and this will be very helpful to you, I think, if you take more courses in ethics or study Rothbard and also Mises, you'll understand this key point. So, okay, so I've gone on longer than I should probably, so I now want to go, you can put in questions or comments in either the chat or the Q&A. So I'll just open, wait, I did something wrong here. What did I do here? Okay, so I've got both of them open now, so you can just type in your questions, your objections, derogatory remarks, anything you like. Jeff said, whose side are you on? Oh, that's a good question. Mises or Rothbard? Well, I think there's a great, I'm inclined to be on Rothbard's side in this, although I think there's a good deal, I'm impressed by how much Mises can get out of the very minimal assumptions he has. But I do think there's sort of an objective, there's a force to ethics that I don't think is fully captured by the hypothetical way of looking at things. I know Danny would disagree with me on this. Now, Mao says, what are the philosophers believe that ethics is objective? This major dividing line philosophy, is it? Yes, it is. It's the one that I very much was trying to stress. So that's a very good question. You've got one of the key points in the lecture. But you find people think ethics is objective. You find people believe in natural law, and also followers of Kant, who had a different view of ethics from natural law, but he also believed ethics is objective. Now, Leslie said, regarding ought we do what we ought to do, ought we do what we need to flourish, suppose I ask, is 12 the square root of 144? The question makes sense, but that doesn't mean 12 is the square root of 144 is not deductively true. Just because the question about the tautology makes sense does not mean the tautology is invalid. That's an interesting point. Well, but you see, you're certainly right. It's deductively true that 12 is a square root of 144, but is it the case, though, that 12, that the number, suppose you say, what is the meaning of the number of 12? It wouldn't seem like the answer to that is the square root of 144. So, on this argument, say, ought we to do what we need to flourish? Somebody could say, well, maybe you could somehow, possibly, it's not ruled out that you could deduce you should do what you need to flourish from the concept of ought, but how can it be that ought just means doing what you need to flourish? So I don't think your example would really show that it was, that this open question argument was wrong, but maybe your example does show you don't, maybe your example does show that possibly you could accept the open question argument and still claim some kind of deductive basis for the kind of thing Rothbard wants. But see, difficulty there, I know it's a bit convoluted, but the difficulty there is unless you make it definitional in this very strict sense, it isn't clear how you would be able to deduce you should do what you need to flourish. If you define it that way, then it does make sense, but if you define it that way, then you have to ask, why doesn't this open question argument apply? But your question is very an interesting one, but I'm not sure your example really is exactly the same as the one that we want here. Now we have another question, how do you see IP playing into Rothbard's views on self-ownership? Well, Rothbard tends to be critical of, he didn't accept patents, he did accept copyright, but I don't think he'd claim, maybe he would, but I wonder how the argument would go, I don't think he'd claim that just strictly follows deductively from self-ownership. You'd have to have additional arguments there. Okay, now Malcolm says, if one accepts that ethics are inherently subjective, does that necessitate that one then have a positive point of view? Can you be subjective without being positive? Oh yes, yes, I mean certainly. I mean this is just a view about ethics. You wouldn't have to hold positivist views on theory of knowledge or anything else. I mean, there are other people besides positivists who hold this subjectivist view of ethics. Craig says, property right, leaving no room for legitimate state seems like an enormous claim. Certainly knows Vic and Randall Locke would not have agreed. Well, you're right, that is a substantial claim that people would disagree with, but I think Rothbard would just respond by trying to show what was wrong with particular arguments that those and other philosophers have given for the state. But you're right, that is, I mean, it isn't an obvious claim, but it isn't something that's obviously true, but it is something that Rothbard held to be true. But you're quite right, that is the claim that would have to be argued for in detail. Well, we have we still have about 15 minutes left. Anybody have any good objections? Now, Leslie asked, who was the skinniest philosopher? Let's see, who was anybody? Well, I think Spinoza wasn't too heavy, was tubercular, or he had some sort of lung disease, so I think he wasn't one who was, let me see, I don't, were there any who were really exceptionally thin? I'm not coming up with anybody who was really known as kind of a, you know, the kind of person, they turn sideways, they disappear. Another fat one was Frank Ramsey, 20th century philosopher. I'm not thinking of anybody who's really extraordinarily thin. I'd have to look into that. Now, Jessica, did Rothbard and Mises discuss this issue? Well, that's a very good question. Mises was certainly aware of Rothbard's views in his review, very positive review of Man, Economy, and State. He indicates that he doesn't agree with Rothbard in certain ethical and legal questions, but I don't think they ever argued about it. They did argue about anarchism, but I don't, certainly Rothbard never mentioned to me any discussions with Mises on this issue. I think it was one Mises had his mind kind of very firmly made up on the matter, and so did Rothbard. I don't think they thought they had much chance of getting anywhere with the other. So I just... that would be just my surmise. Maybe I'm wrong, but I don't think they really did argue about it. Now, Craig said, given that Rand and Rothbard both rejected Hume's version of is ought, don't you think they're closer in argument than either is to Mises? He rejected any is ought connection where Rothbard and Rand accounted for free will. Well, I think you're right. They are closer in that way. And in fact, Rothbard ethics in some ways resembles Rand's. And some of the objectivists thought he plagiarized from Rand, but actually gotten the views were just part of a general natural law view. He didn't accept certain distinctive views that she held, such as ethical egoism. But you're right. They do both reject Hume's law, whereas Mises accepted it. But free will would be a different issue. I think maybe you could argue Rothbard and Rand were closer on free will, but that's a separate issue from the Hume's law. Now, Malcolm says, Hoppe wrote in the intro, what did Rothbard write later in life regarding the rights of children and the exclusionary aspects of private property? What is the exclusionary aspect of private property? I don't think Rothbard really wrote anything on rights of children other than what's in Ethics of Liberty, and that was pretty much he was taking over from Bill Evers. I think that's a more problematic section of the book, actually. We're not going to be discussing that. I'm not going to be lecturing on it, but I don't think that was a topic that he really wrote a lot. He went against Locke there, and Locke specifically rejects the view we can homestead children, but in that section he differs with Locke. Now, exclusionary aspects of private property just means, suppose you own particular land, you have a right to say, I can't come on that land. You can stop other people from going on it. It's up to you who can enter your property, who can't. So that's what is meant by exclusionary aspect of private property. And now Craig says, as to Hume's law, I mentioned free will because of the discussion of should as regards flourishing. Sorry, I wasn't clear. That is why they are so close in argument. Oh, I see. That's a very good point, Grace. You might be thinking, well, if we're talking about what people should do, aren't we at least presupposing that they're free to decide what they're going to do? But so don't they have free will in that way? But I think in that sense, certainly Mises would have accepted that also. And Malthus says, are all rights ethically enforceable with the use of force? What about rights that are not voiced or assigned? Are natural rights enforceable by force when those who have not voiced a desire for them or assign them? And who gets to use force to enforce them? I'm not sure what exactly I'm saying your question. Do you mean something like this? Suppose we say something like this. I have a right that you not, that people have a right that their possessions not be taken from them, but suppose somebody doesn't mind people taking some objection, doesn't mind if people take his property, who could enforce that? Well, I think in that case, the person would be consenting to have the property taken, so question wouldn't come up. And I see, you meant something else. Could you have cases where an infant aggressed, the parents aggressed against an infant, and the infant isn't saying, well, I don't want you to do this, or you're going against me. The infant isn't able to voice his rights. Well, I don't think, of course, the question of what rights infants have is a difficult one, but in general, rights don't depend on voicing them. Let's say there's somebody who's unconscious, you can't come up to the person and say, well, he didn't say I couldn't steal his wallet. He's just lying there. He didn't tell me not to do it. Rights wouldn't be dependent on the claim that people have them. They either have them or they don't. Now, Kevin said, Murphy is an anarchist, made it point to leave interpretation laws to private judges in a private law society. was it not for Rothbard to fill in all the details regarding copyright that he did? Everyone has a great view on what punishments, etc., should be given out for certain violations. Unlike Block, in a way, would it have been better to simply make a case that expert judges would prosper on an open market? That's a very good question. But you see, I think Rothbard thought that at least certain matters were capable of being resolved by reason. So suppose you say, well, let's leave it all to the judges. Well, now imagine you're an expert judge. Say they hire you as an expert judge. So how would you decide one of these cases? You couldn't say, well, let's just go by what the expert judges say, because you are one of the expert judges. So the question would be, well, what are the body of principles that these judges should decide according to? You couldn't solve that by just saying, well, let's leave it up to the judges, unless you want to say whatever they choose to decide just is the right course. Now, of course, it doesn't follow from that that all of what Rothbard or any of what Rothbard says about these details is correct, but you can see why he wouldn't want, just want to say, well, it's just up to the judges, because then we can always ask, well, suppose you are one of the judges, how should you decide? You can't just answer that by saying it's up to the judges. Now, Craig says, how opposed was MRC idea of common law? We objectively grow something on the order of a contemporary Hanseatic leap, but do you see such a thing example of, say, David Friedman's argument that different legal codes would arise, and thus some people would be subject to Sharia, for example? You see, Rothbard would certainly not oppose common law. In fact, he thought there was a lot, had come up with some good ideas, but what he would reject would just be the view that because something had developed or evolved in a certain way, that it can't then be questioned. So I think Rothbard would accept developments of people's legal systems through custom and evolution, but he would still say they could be subjected to the test of reason. So possibly Sharia wouldn't pass that, or at least certain aspects of it wouldn't. So what he's rejecting is just the view that if something is evolved through custom, that's all you need to know about it to accept it. Okay, we have time. Maybe anybody have a last question or objection? Now, Craig said, I can't find this anywhere. What did Rothbard think of Russell Kirk, in particular the conservative mind? I know they spoke well of Calhoun. Well, Kirk had more to say about Rothbard than the other way around. Russell Kirk didn't thought Rothbard was too dogmatic. I think Rothbard really didn't regard Kirk as a very important thinker. He respected other conservatives like Wilmore Kendall, but not Kirk so much. Malcolm, can you talk about where the Cato Institute is today in relation to Rothbard? Well, I think of course, Cato split with Rothbard in 1980. Written about that. I mean, I think they sometimes, particular writers, would cite him, but he isn't one of the really major people for them anymore. Sometimes they would regard him, I think, as just one of the early libertarians, but they think he's probably been superseded. And Malcolm said, has anyone or group of authors undertaken to write the third volume of History, Economic, Political Thought, or the second volume leaves off? No, there are some articles that Rothbard wrote that could probably be gathered for that, but no one's done that. It's been suggested that they do that, but nobody does it. Nobody's done it yet. Now, let's see, here's one. Hoffer, give a quotation from Hans Hoffer. Does libertarianism require sociological presupposition, cultural conservatism? Well, I don't know that it requires it. I mean, I think Rothbard thought it was compatible with cultural conservatism when he preferred that, favored it. But I don't think he'd say it's required, but that was his personal view of the matter. And Craig said he love to see Volume 5 of Consumer Liberty. Well, that would certainly be nice to have. I mean, one hears from time to time reports there was such a volume in manuscripts and people can't read it. But I don't think there's any, I think whether there is such a volume hasn't really come out yet. It would require further investigation. I don't have any immediate plans to come up with that. Well, all right. Thanks very much. So I guess we hope to see you all next week. And I hope I didn't make the lecture too complicated. I did think this is a really key issue in ethics, so I wanted to go over it and probably I went over it in rather tedious detail. Okay. Thanks a lot, everybody.